the UCR Podcast.
Steve Stevens was part of some of the most interesting and innovative sounding albums of the 80s through his collaboration with Billy Idol. And in today's conversation, Steve talks about some of the formative things for him as a music fan that helped to shape the creative musician that he eventually became. Steve also has a cool new series of signature guitars that we discuss, and he takes us behind the scenes of the huge production that he and Billy have out on the road on the current summer tour with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. He shares some stories about his time touring with Vince Neil and opening for Van Halen, and the tale of how he met Robert Palmer. Dream Into It is Steve's latest album with Billy, and you can keep up with everything that he has going on at his website, stevestevensguitar.com. If this is your first time listening to the UCR Podcast, make sure to follow it so you will receive future episodes as they're released. If you dig what you're hearing, rate and review wherever you're listening. Here's our interview with Steve Stevens. Enjoy. Obviously, you guys are out touring presently. Let's start there. Like, tell me about this current tour with Billy, because, I mean, the staging looks pretty incredible.
Yeah, I'd say that this is probably the biggest tour we've done since Rebel Yell. Well, maybe Whiplash Smile. That was a big production. But we felt the time was right. You know, I'm always the one saying, you know, when we sit down to talk about, you know, lights and all this, I say, don't forget that the best special effect we have is the chemistry between Billy and I, you know. We don't want pyro. That's not the type of band that we are. But I think, you know, now with our projection screens and stuff, people, you know, there's video cameras on band members so they can see us from way back in the hall. And you know, our emphasis is always to reflect the songs, you know. What is the lighting? What is the video visuals have to do with the song? And we try and keep to that formula.
Yeah. And I mean, this new album seems like it gave you a lot to work with in that regard, like as far as like possible visuals, but like just generally, like when it comes to what we're seeing on this current tour, like how did the overall concept for the look of it kind of come together?
It still has a bit of a, you know, punk rock aesthetic, you know, kind of the, you know, super high intensity colors. You know, I think there's projections of some of the classic videos that we did back in the 80s during the songs. So, you know, people that grew up with us through those years are reminded of that stuff. And then there's some really cool visuals that are happening that we were able to play with some of the song themes, you know, or titles. There's some good animation happening. So, you know, I think we try to be as creative as possible with this stuff.
Yeah, I think there's kind of, when you have a legacy like this, it's like there's kind of some fun that you can have with the visuals, like building in some Easter eggs that like are things that like the fans are going to see as they're kind of like taking in the whole show as a whole that are just kind of fun to put in there.
Yeah. And you know, we still look pretty good. So you're not, you know, you're seeing us back in the day and then you're looking at us and going, yeah, okay. I've seen a couple of bands where, you know, they show the classic videos and then you see them on stage. They're barely recognizable. So we're like, yeah, we're still those guys, you know, we still, you know, we still believe in being rock stars up there and have fun with it.
Well, you've got these really cool new signature guitars, hand-built in Nashville. And I think the one that I really dig is the Ascender Premier in Josie Pink. That's just a great color. It looks particularly cool. And I know that a lot of the guys that I talk to about developing something like this, sometimes they take the prototypes out on the road and kind of figure out how they need to be tweaked in that fashion by playing them. What was the process like for you, you know, as far as, you know, being in the development process for these guitars, like where did the ideas start and how did they kind of evolve?
Well, a number of years ago, I was approached by Ciari with their first version of the guitar. I had some, you know, I mean, it's an absolute feat of engineering, but does it stand up whether or not it folds up or not? You know, I don't want to be associated with a gimmick first of all. I thought conceptually it's great because they've designed a guitar that folds up, fits in a backpack, and fits under the seat of a plane. And, you know, the current way that musicians work is, you know, you're touring, but you're also recording in your hotel rooms and, you know, either writing new songs or, you know, you're mixing. It's not like the old days where you'd have a recording and then a tour cycle and then recording. It's all mixed in together. So I thought that the idea of having this guitar was great because I could record, you know, while being on the road. I had some reservations about the neck joint and the stability of it, and they addressed that, and they redesigned it and retooled it so that the neck joint is really solid. And then they said, "Hey, would you want to do a signature version?" And I said, "Well, you know, my wife was there at the very first meeting. She loves pink. Let's do a Josie Pink version." And we got special pickups designed for it from Bare Knuckles out of the UK, which is the company I've worked with for 20 years now. And then I, you know, kind of gave them my input as far as some graphic aesthetics. We got my Raygun logo on there, which the pickup selector has an indicator light, so you can easily know what pickup you're on. I always thought, I always wondered why other guitar players other guitar companies didn't do that as well, so that you could, you know, just look down at your guitar and go, "Oh, I'm on the neck pickup," you know, and not have to, you know, it's kind of foolproof.
Yeah, I always kind of wonder, like, how some of you guys do that too. Like, you know, when sometimes you're dealing with some pretty involved production and smoke machines and all that kind of stuff, does it help in that regard too?
It does. I mean, it's you know, it looks cool, but it also has a very great visual, you know, indicator. And also, there's a built-in tuner on the guitar, because when you unfold the neck, it's 95% in tune, right?
Wow.
But you want to be absolutely in tune. So I thought, you know, let's put this pickup ring tuner on there so that, you know, a couple of little tweaks on there and you're perfectly in tune. You don't need to buy a guitar tuner or anything.
Considering where you started, man, that's got to be pretty wild that you now have a guitar that, like, you don't have to check. You don't necessarily have to have it on a seat next to you and buy another seat on the plane. Like, it's just like, I guess from what you're telling me, you could literally put this thing in a backpack and put it under your seat, you know, following the airline's rules that everything has to be under your seat in front of you and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. It comes with its own backpack. So it's all, you know, you know, complete kit, so to speak. I mean, you know, I'd always, you know, pray when I was traveling with a guitar, you know, will it fit in the overhead? And there's always those moments where the case was too big to fit over in the overhead on the plane. They take it and you see it from your seat. You see it being carted off and you're like, "Oh man, I hope it makes it in one piece." And, you know, I've had some mishaps with guitars on airplanes.
I was going to say, we recently put up a list of, you know, just various musicians over the years that one thing or another, they lost a guitar. And in some cases, like Peter Frampton's one of the famous ones where he got it back. He calls the guitar his Phoenix, you know. Did you have a situation like that where it's like there's a guitar that, you know, meant something to you that went away and did you get it back?
No, not in my case. No.
Good.
You know, I'm not a guitar collector, so to speak. They're tools, and I'm a big proponent that I feel that modern guitars are even better than classic guitars. That's just my view on it. I think the technology and the craftsmanship is better now. I know there's guys who believe that a 59 Les Paul is, you know, if you can afford one, you know, I'd rather buy a house.
Absolutely. And so to that end, when you talk about guitars being tools, how were these particularly helpful as you were working on this new record?
Well, I was able to travel back and forth between Las Vegas, where I live, and Los Angeles, where we track the record. I didn't bring along, you know, a huge arsenal of guitars. Our producer, Tommy English, on this record has some really beautiful guitars, especially some really cool old acoustic guitars. But I was able to bring this guitar with me. And as I said, you know, I keep an apartment in Los Angeles, so I don't have too many guitars there. So I always bring the CRE with me just to, you know, tinker around with and practice.
The fact that the latest album was conceptual, like how much does something like that contribute to your side of things, like compositionally, like how much, and I guess how much were you aware that that was the goal for this record?
It was the goal right from the very get-go. You know, we had discussions that this was basically, you know, going to give a nod to the documentary that Billy has coming out. And, you know, invariably, the day would start, you know, writing a tune with, you know, some telling some, stories about things that occurred or current things. And, you know, our co-songwriter and producer Tommy English really wanted to hear the crazy shit that went on back in the day. And as I always said to him, I said, you know, the music always came first. That's the thing people have to understand. There was a lot of partying. There was a lot of wildness. It was the 80s, and things that were accepted back then are certainly not accepted now. But the music always came first, and we could reward ourselves with whatever only after accomplishing what we needed to accomplish, either great shows on the road or, you know, recording. So you know, that was that's the one thing I want to stress to people, that the music always came first, as it does now. I almost approached my role in this as a director. What's my motivation? What's the storyline? You know, I'm one of those guitar players that really wants to know what the lyrics are, you know, because that's where I take my cue from. I've always been that way. I've always been a band guy who always looked at the relationship between the singer and the guitar player is something really, really cool, right from the time I was a kid when I saw Elvis and Scotty Moore, and then obviously Page and Plant, and, you know, all the, you know, the Axl and Slash. And, you know, I mean, it's a time-tested thing. I think the fans love that. Batman and Robin or whatever, you know. You know, fortunately, I get to work with the guy that I started it with. And I know that we have so many shared life experiences that we can draw on, which are really cool.
I love hearing you put it that way, that you're a director in a sense. And it's like, so yes, there's the storyline, there's the events and things that kind of like play into what's being written about lyrically. But it's like you guys also like created like some really interesting sounds with the songs and albums that you were making. So were you inspired to kind of put any sort of nods to that kind of thing? Just like, you know, certain things you had done on a song or a record, did you find places to put stuff like that in to some of these new songs, callbacks of sorts?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, the design on this record was, let's use as few keyboards as possible. A lot of the things that people may think are keyboards on this record are actually derived from guitar. And we used a lot of, you know, computer plugins and things to give the impression of a keyboard. And that was kind of my idea with Rebel Yell as well. I remember saying to our producer, Keith Forsey, let me try and do it on guitar. I remember seeing on the Queen records, no synthesizers. You know, Brian May took care of all of that on with you orchestrating his guitar. And that's what I try to do. And I always tell the producer, if I don't achieve that, then bring in the keyboards, but let's try and get it from the guitar. And we did that, certainly with this record.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing is like, you know, if we look at like, say the Billy Idol record, and then as you said, Rebel Yell, it's like on the Billy Idol record, it's like you were doing interesting things both, you know, with guitar and with synthesizers. And that seems like that would have been for you as a creative person, an interesting balance to strike. Like, so what was kind of influencing you as you were just, if we look at that initial record, what was kind of influencing you as you're kind of like working on those sounds and kind of, you know, making it all make sense together?
Well, I see really a big similarity between the technology boom that was happening when we did Rebel Yell, with synths becoming polyphonic and programmable, and obviously the Lindrum we used on things like Future Fantasy and Eyes Without a Face. We always embraced the technology because it was fun, you know. It was all new colors to paint with. And I see the same thing happening now. There's an incredible influx of cool things that you can do with computers, you know, with synth plugins and ways to, I'm always looking for ways to manipulate my guitar, you know, because essentially rock guitar has been around since what, 65 with the Stones and Satisfaction and then Jimi Hendrix and then Eddie Van Halen. And where are we? I look at it, where are we at now? What can we do beyond just the technique? Because I never look at recording, certainly a Billy Idol record, as an outlet for some amazing technique where people are going to hold up scorecards after a solo. Or, you know, I felt whenever, you know, it was discussed for solos on this record, I really wanted to minimize them. I felt that modern records don't rely on guitar solos as much. That's not what my role is. Certainly I'm not waiting for my, you know, 20 seconds of glory, 3 minutes into the song. I'm contributing to the whole as a musician. You know, it's one thing to be a guitar player, but there's another thing to have a career as a musician. And I much prefer the musician career.
Did you enjoy, like, back in the day, though, like, crafting solos? Because you had some pretty bonkers one. I mean, Eyes Without a Face, to name one of them.
Yeah, but they were always for a reason, you know. And Billy was always the one to say, you know, I do the solo. And the first one, he goes, that's it. That's the solo, the first take. And I go, wait a minute, I could do it better. And we, you know, spend, you know, half hour, and I'm eventually crawling up, you know, my own tail, and let's listen to that first one again. And eventually we called him the Punk Police, because that was his punk rock ethos. You know, the first one is when you're flying by the seat of your pants, you're not sure, mistake, you know, warts and all, but that's the solo. That's what's great about it. There's an energy in that initial thing rather than, you know, polishing it too much. Don't polish it too much. So, yeah. And I think, you know, I, to a certain extent, I adhere to that philosophy.
There's the way that you did some of those classic solos on record. How much have you watched like some of these like YouTube folks recreate what you do and, you know, see interesting things in the way they kind of attack stuff that you did back then?
They mostly get it wrong. Or, you know, it's amusing. I'm just happy that, you know, some kid, 10 years old is showing how he plays Rebel Yell, you know, a song that's 40, you know, over 40 years old, and it's still relevant, and they're still proud to learn it. You know, I love seeing that. That's really cool. Cause that, you know, that was me when I was a kid, you know, lifting the needle up on, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 or a Genesis record, or I was a big King Crimson fan. And, my favorite bands, like I'd get a Who record, I'd have to buy two copies because I was going to destroy the one copy by putting the needle on and playing it at half speed. So I had my listening copy and my learning copy. So I love seeing when, you know, people are excited about learning something that we've done.
What did you appreciate about Genesis? Because like, I know that every time I talk to Steve Hackett, like he's one of those guys that just what he does is fascinating, but just like, I always learn something every time I talk to him. He's just a fascinating guy. And they were a fascinating band.
You know, musically adventurous, but, you know, with Peter Gabriel in the band, they were visually exciting as well. That's what I always tell musicians, that if you're going to do something that's really technical, you know, one of the first concert I ever went to see was Emerson, Lake and Palmer on the Brain Salad Surgery Tour. So this, we're talking 1973 at Madison Square Garden, but it was visually incredible. And Keith Emerson made what he was doing so exciting. Guy was a rock star. He was the Jimi Hendrix of keyboards. And the sound was great and the visuals were great. They had projections. But getting back to your question about Steve Hackett, so I started on guitar when I was 7 and a half, and that the initial stuff was all the folk stuff that was happening. I didn't get an electric guitar till I was 13. So it's James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, John Fahey, you know, blues stuff, Hot Tuna, Yarma Kerkounen. So I had this background of folk. Then I started to take classical guitar lessons, and I had a teacher who delved into some jazz stuff. So when I heard the progressive guys, they were utilizing all these styles within the context of a rock band. Certainly Steve Hackett played some beautiful classical guitar pieces and some psychedelic stuff, very Robert Fripp influenced. So what I loved about him was I could take all this stuff that I had already learned and, you know, apply it to a rock band rather than, you know, guys like Clapton, who's a brilliant guitar player, but basically plugged in and played White Man Blues. That was, to me, not, it just didn't tickle my fancy as much as the guys who were like really stylistically going everywhere. Steve Howe from Yes with his a bit of Les Paul. And Chet Atkins. Steve Howe really is a Chet Atkins nut. And also his classical stuff. So I loved all those kind of prog rock guys. You know, eventually it reached a point where it all had to, you know, it wasn't adventurous anymore. And obviously in New York, we had CBGBs, which was, you know, the new, you know, kind of wipe the slate clean and let's start over again. And let's get back to, you know, what was exciting about rock and roll in the first place. And, you know, that always, music goes in cycles. Grunge was the same to the 80s. You know, there's always a cleaning of the palate in musical styles.
Yeah, and at the same point, it's like all that prog rock stuff seems like that would have given you like just an interesting palette of ideas in addition to everything else you're talking about as you get into the 80s and start like working on your own stuff. Like, it, you know, hearing that you had all that stuff as influences like makes it make more sense thinking about everything that you were doing, kind of marrying guitars and keys and all sorts of other things together like you did on those records.
Absolutely. And those guitar players orchestrated the songs, and that's what I continue to do. I orchestrate a song. Let's put some acoustic guitar here in the verse, and let's get heavy in the chorus. And that's a big part of what I do is orchestrate, you know, and arrange my guitar parts so that they are almost in the sense of classical arrangements. And I mean Jimmy Page was brilliant at arranging, you know. That's why those songs, yeah, this incredible drummer and, you know, singer and all that, but the arrangements on those Led Zeppelin records, you know, for a four-piece band is just, you know, that's Jimmy being the session guy and learning all that stuff. So it's, I definitely took cues from those kind of records.
I love hearing you mention CBGBs, those too, because just like that's kind of, I think, a crucial moment as a music fan. If you've gone to like, say, arena shows and all that kind of stuff, but then you like discover like just a club experience like that, and especially a place like that, like that kind of like unlocks something else in your brain, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, I went to the High School of Performing Arts, the FAME school. I was I auditioned on guitar, and then when I got into the school, the guitar is not a part of an orchestra. There's no guitar section, so they said, "Oh, well, you have to pick another instrument." Well, I've been playing this one thing for my whole life, and so I played viola. I was the worst viola player, and I really kind of like lost interest and. And it was my every day I'd be in Manhattan. So it's really exciting, you know, and the music stores were two blocks away. So I'd leave on my lunch break and never return back to school. And there was a student who was kind of he grew up in Manhattan, and he said, "Hey, you know what the Mercer Arts Center is? You ever been there?" "No, what's that?" You know, so I hung out, went to his apartment. Family's house, and then we went to the Mercer Arts Center afterwards, and I forgot who it was we saw. One of the bands, I don't remember.
Sure,
I don't even remember. But so over breakfast the next morning, I tell my mom I'm dropping out of high school. I saw my education, and it's not in the school; it's out there. It didn't go over well, but I did. She said, "Oh, you have to get your GED, your diploma." So I got my GED and I joined a band, and I got out there and I just started gigging and playing. And that's when, television, Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, and Robert Fripp had moved to New York and was hanging out with Chris Stein from Blondie. And it was all this exciting music, and there was bands being signed, and it was a scene, and there was record labels that were out every night to see the band. So there was supply and demand, and I was so fortunate to be in Manhattan at that time. And then I joined a band and I moved into the city, and I'm still friends with a lot of the guys that I hung out with then. I lived in a big music building, 10 floors of all musicians. And
oh, man.
Yeah. And Cyndi Lauper lived there, and Dead Boys would be in there. And I'd see Johnny Thunders and Sylvain, who actually helped give me my stage name. And it was just, man, it was, I look back at it now and really was like being in a movie. You know, it was really an incredible time to be in New York. I mean, the city was decaying, and it was dangerous, but you could afford, musicians and artists could afford to live there. I think we paid $300 a month for our loft, and it was just great. And a lot of really good guitar players were getting gigs at that time, and they're still, Eddie Martinez, who went on to do Run DMC and Robert Palmer, and all of these guys were my fellow guitar players, I think the scene nurtured us.
I talked to Eddie earlier this year. Is that any part of how you got to know Robert, or that happened differently?
Robert was the first rock star I ever met.
man, he is a rock star.
So the band that I was in before, joining up with Billy Idol, we recorded an album that was never released for Island Records, and we were down in the Bahamas at Compass Point. We were the first band in after Back in Black was recorded, and Robert Whoa. Lived across this. Yeah, Robert lived across the street and wandered into the studio and heard some tracks and said, "Who's the guitar player?" I raised my hand, said, "That would be me, sir." And we met, he was my buddy from that point on when he come through New York. And this is before I joined up with Billy Idol. And then we hung out in New York when he was doing the Power Station. And then eventually I got to record with him.
Yeah. And I mean, from talking to Eddie, like Robert just seems like he approached the art of like recording in such an interesting way. Like he obviously made some cool records that we, have as evidence of that, but it's just like, he was another one that was just doing really cool things.
It was so musical. I remember when we were in, he'd say, "Oh, can you play the A sus ninth chord?" So Robert, I have no idea what that is. And he picked up the guitar and showed me. He was a musician's musician. We sat around listening to James Brown records because he was really getting his grooves from those classic R&B records. And he turned me on to some pretty cool R&B stuff, Neville Brothers, and some stuff that I wasn't aware of, the New Orleans stuff. And then he says, you know, he started to tell me what it was like to do gigs with Jimi Hendrix. And man, he was an encyclopedia of music and experience. Really great guy. Really fantastic guy.
Well, that's right. That's it right there. Encyclopedia of music, because Eddie was telling me how like Robert like gave him a mixtape at one point that had Sepultura on it and Husker Du. It's just like he listened to all sorts of folks that, you know, people might not expect that Robert Palmer was listening to. And it's like, and I think that as you know, because you're the same way, it's like you listen to all sorts of stuff. I think that's kind of the classic thing, is that people box a player into a certain box based on the music that they've heard the guy make. But obviously we know your love of flamenco and just like everything that you have been into over the years. It's just like whatever a particular person is playing, there's always all this other stuff that they're into as well.
Yeah, I always laugh because I tell people I don't listen to guitar music because that's what I do. And I'm always looking for other things to influence my playing. So whether it's, flamenco or electronic. I went through a period where I was listening to a lot of, classical music, just for the arrangement factors. I'd kind of analyze and go, oh, what are the cellos doing here? Okay, they're doing a counter melody to this. And you could always apply that to music. I think, one of our great guitar players, influences on us all was Alan Holdsworth, and Alan was trying to replicate John Coltrane. He was, in his mind, he was sounding like Coltrane.
The first time I saw you play was not with Billy, but when you were out with Vince opening for Van Halen, and it's just like one could imagine that there'd be trepidation playing guitar knowing that Eddie Van Halen is somewhere in the building. Like, were you affected by that at all? Like, you had done a lot, obviously. Like, so it's just like you had plenty of confidence, but still, like, I just wondered how much that was a factor.
I certainly avoided an electric guitar extended solo piece because Vince said, "Oh, you got to do a guitar solo," and I thought, well, if I do an electric solo in about an hour, this guy's going to come out and play Eruption, and the game over. I thought, well, what do I do that is nothing like Eddie Van Halen? And that's how my flamenco nylon string solo came to be. I developed that, and that's now basically the same solo spot that I do with Billy Idol, and it's unique to what I do. There's very few guitar players I think that could just stand on a stage with an electric guitar and have people that don't really give a shit about guitars be entertained. And I think that's the key. Jeff Beck's Blow by Blow was a record that, whether you cared about guitar or not, it was enjoyable. I hate to say it, but my wife's a really good litmus test of that because she listens to more current R&B stuff. And I have to pass the muster with her with music, and because she's really not really interested in an extended guitar thing. I remember we went to see I'll leave the guitarist name out, but we had a judge a contest, and name, very well respected shred guitar player got there, and my wife could not wait to get out of there. But she loves great guitar playing, but you have to entertain people. As I said with Keith Emerson, you have to make it entertaining. You know, it cannot just be noodling around.
Last couple things from my side. One of the things you got to do last year that I got to see here in Cleveland that was incredible to witness was the tribute to Ozzy at the Rock Hall inductions. I wondered, what were the preparations and rehearsals like getting ready for that?
Well, it was kind of cool because I had done the track with Ozzy and Billy Morrison, which the aptly named Crack Cocaine. So I had worked with Ozzy and he loves Billy Idol, and we were really glad to be a part of it. It was a really good cast of characters. You know, obviously Zakk Wylde, who's a phenomenal guitar player. And then you had Wolfgang, who I first met as a little baby, you know. And so you had what was cool was you had the next generation. You had Wolfgang, and also on keyboards was Adam Wakeman, Rick Wakeman's son. And I remember saying to Billy, we're really passing the torch here with this. And, you know, it was, and we were all there for Ozzy. It was all about giving props to a guy who's iconic, absolutely a legend, you know?
Yeah, it was really fun watching Wolfgang do his thing. Like, here's a guy that's like really doing it, you know, for the love of the music, and watching him peel off that solo for Crazy Train. Like, I mean, he's just an amazing player. Like, he's one of those guys that, as we know, like from the way he's making those records, he can play any instrument you throw at him. And it was kind of fun watching him like get thrown into the Ozzy stew and, you know, interpret that.
Well, what I didn't realize, what I was told afterwards, that there was a bit of a rivalry between Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen, that it was not the most friendly thing in that Hollywood circle. And it was really great for Wolfgang to like play that solo, and like all of that other stuff didn't matter. It was still, and also I had been involved the year before with getting Randy Rhoads inducted to the Hall of Fame. We did an acoustic piece, a version of Crazy Train. And, I was involved with that.
I really enjoyed that, man. That must've been like, you know, you've done these reworkings of things over the years, you know, and like, that must've been a lot of fun to get a chance to reinterpret that song.
Also knowing that, Randy was still studying classical guitar even while being in Ozzy's band. And I felt like, you know, again, I'm not recreating on electric guitar what Randy had, you know, put into the Mount Rushmore. Crazy Train solo is one of those Mount Rushmore guitar solos. So here I was doing it on a flamenco guitar in a way that I would hope Randy would appreciate.
That's fantastic. Well, Steve, I want to let you run on, but thank you always for the time, and, you know, have a great one. We'll look forward to seeing you when you come around with Billy this summer, and always a pleasure, sir.
Yeah, same here. Thank you.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening, and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.